This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 158 was recorded on March 14th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Petroleum geologist Art Berman joins me as this week's feature interview guest. As regular listeners know, Art is one of our all-time most popular guests and is known for his excellent graphs and charts. As per usual, Art has another great slide deck for you this week. We let Art's interview run long because there's so much to cover in energy markets. So we're going to have a reasonably short post-game segment this week in which Patrick and I will discuss both technical levels on oil as well as reviewing Charlie McElligott's Ides of March thesis in response to several emails from listeners who were left confused about exactly what Charlie is and is not predicting after his cameo appearance on last week's post-game segment.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 seems to have been bought on dip with some vengeance. We quickly undid almost all of that selling from the prior week and find ourselves once again at that critical overhead resistance around the 28 and a quarter. Do we break through? What's your thinking here on the S&P?
Well, Patrick, this is very consistent with Charlie McElligott's melt up into quad witching, which of course is tomorrow, Friday. I ended up covering my short expecting this to happen. And certainly per Charlie's prognosis, this is what we should have expected. Now, a lot of people seem to be confused. We had a few tweets from people saying, hey, Charlie said the market was going to go down and it didn't. Actually, that's not what Charlie said. So in the postgame segment, we will clarify and review exactly what Charlie is and is not predicting. Meanwhile, where we are now, we've closed back above the 78.6 Fibonacci level. Normally, that would be a pretty strong indication that the rally is back on and we're headed maybe toward new all-time highs. Now, that may be what happens. The vulnerability that Charlie has described comes in the second half of the month, and let's discuss that in the post-game segment so that we understand where those risks lie.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index because we were testing those November and December highs just a week ago. Felt like the dollar was finally going to make that break, and here we step back and we find ourselves with a dollar index hovering more or less around the 97 handle at the time of recording. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Well, it's true that we have had a pullback, but to me, this is another what I'll call a so-what pullback. When we spoke last week, we had just broken out to a new contract high. That was a very bullish indication. It's very normal after a breakout that you end up drifting down and retesting what was previously a resistance level and see if it turns into a support level. Now, that level probably should have been 97. We went a bit below that, but we're back up and appear to be bouncing already. Meanwhile, the series of higher lows and higher highs is very much intact. If you draw a linear trend line through the last two lows, this low that we just put in ends up being considerably above that. So we didn't even really test the bottom of the price channel. As far as I'm concerned, this is all still perfectly healthy pullback in a bull market. It's potentially even a buy the dip opportunity here, and it looks to me like it's already bottoming. Now, certainly, if we take out 96 to the downside, and particularly 95 to the downside, that would be a whole other story. But everything I see here is perfectly healthy pullback in a bull market.
Well, let's move on to crude oil. I can't think of a better episode for us to have Art on. We just had crude oil yesterday break to a 3-month high north of $58 on West Texas. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, to be sure, the OPEC cuts, sanctions on Iran and Venezuela, the United States clarified, hey, we said there was a temporary waiver on Iran. It's only temporary. It's going to expire. Don't expect an extension. Then sanctions on Venezuela, all these things add up to create a lot of bullish sentiment. Now, I'm going to abbreviate most of my fundamental commentary because I want to defer to Art's greater wisdom on the subject. So let's briefly cover the inventory story this week because it was a really big one. Crude oil drawing down 3.9 million barrels. Now, first of all, that's a big drawdown in any circumstance. But this is restocking season, and furthermore, it's refinery maintenance season, when normally what happens is we've got not enough oil being consumed and the builds start to really pile up because with the refineries in their maintenance season, they can't use as much oil. What we have is in this seasonal time of year during refinery maintenance, when we should expect builds on inventory, we got a real big 4 million, 3.9 million barrel drawdown. So that was a really big bullish shock. Cushing, Oklahoma, which had been in a trend of building even in weeks when there were drawdowns nationally, drawing down 672,000 barrels, another huge 4.6 million barrel drawdown on top of 4.2 million barrels last week on gasoline. Distillates drawing down only 383,000 barrels, but still drawdowns across the board during a time of year when we would expect to see builds on inventory. So there were really massively bullish signals. Now, there's a couple of caveats to that. That was a really, really, really bullish inventory print. And the market's reaction initially was really not to move very much. And after it kind of thought about it for an hour or two, finally the market moved higher into the pit close at 2:30 on Wednesday afternoon. So on inventory day, even with a really bullish report, it didn't instantly propel the market higher. It did get the market higher, but only after a fashion. So the way I would look at this is it says to me we've got very bullish news, very, very bullish news, but I do feel that the market is getting tired. It didn't react as big to the upside as I would have expected. And it was a breakout, as you say, to a high in recent weeks, recent months, actually. It probably has farther to go. I do note, though, that into the pit close today on Thursday, we saw RBOB gasoline giving up what had been just a really huge bull move through one technical level at one spot, 85.60. The next technical level where I would really get concerned that maybe this whole move is reversing would be RBOB closing below its five-day moving average. That hasn't happened yet, but there was quite a bit of weakness in RBOB, no weakness in crude late day. Usually RBOB is the tell. It tends to forecast what happens next for crude. So there's at least a possible early indication that this might be ending sooner than a lot of people expect. But at the same time, hey, we got bullish fundamental news with the Iran sanctions, Venezuela sanctions. Then we got a further impetus of bullish news with inventory. There's so many reasons for this market to be going up that that's what it's been doing. I'm just not sure how much farther it has to go. Right now, though, the trend is positive. Everything's above the short-term moving averages. That suggests that a strong uptrend is in place. I don't think we're headed back to $75 oil, but let's see what Art Berman says.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold bullion, obviously, last week was ending some pretty aggressive selling. And this week has been a consolidation, almost a straddling of the 1,300 level on bullion. Do you think that gold can make another spurt higher? What's your thinking on gold?
Well, I really have two views competing with one another. One is I see that it seems like, okay, I couldn't understand why gold had been so strong even when the dollar was rising and I would have expected more weakness. And I'm talking back a couple of months ago now. Kind of got the answer, which is it really wanted to test that 1350 key resistance level, and that resistance level was rejected very firmly. So now one side of my brain is saying, okay, that rejection sets us up for maybe a substantial move lower, down to 1100, say. On the other hand, I see a lot of signs there. We continue to have some days where gold is selling off aggressively, other days where it's really trading like a risk hedge. And when we get bad news, gold is spiking up as other assets are selling off. So it seems like gold is, on one hand, got some headwind from the dollar, which I think is going to continue to move higher. On the other hand, at the same time, it seems like the old, hey, if the dollar's up, it's got to mean gold is down. That's faded to, it creates a headwind for gold, but not necessarily, especially if the world is falling apart at the seams. And when that happens, gold tends to go up, and we're seeing it trading in that context. So I do keep feeling like, maybe my bearish view on gold needs to be revisited because the fundamentals are changing such that it's not trading just as an inverse dollar trade the way it used to. At the same time, until I see above 1350 on a sustained basis, closing there and staying there for a week, say, or moving quickly above that, that would be the breakout that really tells me the move is on. And yeah, I'd be late to the table if that happened, but I'm not rushing in to buy it here.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, because for the entire month of February, every time the yields dropped about to 2.64 level on the downside, the buyers supported that yield level. And then this week, have seen a decisive break all the way down to 2.60. I mean, is this the beginning of a new breakdown in yields?
Well, 260 is a key level that I've been watching for a long time, and you know it appears to be, but of course support levels are called support levels for a reason, and that is that's where they tend to reverse. So what I'm looking for, Patrick, is a daily close below 2.60 that moves and stays below 2.60 for a few days. That would tell me, maybe we've really got a trend in motion that's going to take us to substantially lower treasury yields. Otherwise, this could be where it reverses and we head back up toward 2.80, the other end of this trading range that we've been in. But I think we're right on the cusp of what could be a breakdown to lower yields.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is Art Berman. Eric, why did we invite Art back to the show as this week's featured guest?
Well, Art has been one of our most popular guests since we launched this program 3 years ago, Patrick. Of course, he's a petroleum geologist, and what I really like about Art is he's not a Wall Street guy. He doesn't come at this from a trader, a trading desk, fund manager kind of background. He's a guy that actually drills oil wells for a living and is an expert on the geology and so forth. He's at this point in his career, I think he's kind of shifted to where he's had such a great track record with his forecasting ability based on his comparative inventory model, which he did a whole class about in Vancouver at Macro Voices Live. That really has propelled him to be recognized as one of the most authoritative voices around on the direction of crude oil prices because that model has been so accurate. So it's been too long. Last time we had him on, oil was at $75 and he was very outspoken in saying this is way too high. It's going to go down. I don't know when, but it's going to go down. It's going to move lower. Needless to say, it moved a lot lower, and it'll be very interesting to see where Art thinks it's headed next.
All right. Well, Eric's interview with Art Berman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me as this week's featured interview guest is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Now, for newer listeners who may not be familiar with Art's work, I encourage you to listen to Art's prior interviews. You can just go and type Art Berman into the search box at macrovoices.com, and you'll find 7 or 8 prior appearances. We are going to be making reference to comparative inventory, which simply described the government inventory numbers tell you whether the amount of oil in storage went up or down each week. That's not seasonally adjusted, which is what's really important in order to understand the relevance of that data. So Art uses a comparative inventory model, which compares the amount of supply added or subtracted from storage to what the 5-year moving average is for this week of the year in previous years. If you want a full description of how comparative inventory works, it's described in one of Art's prior interviews. Art has sent us another fantastic slide deck. He's known for his graphs and charts. So be sure to download the chart deck and you'll find the link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the download link next to Art's picture on our homepage. Art, why don't we go ahead and dive into your slide deck, since everybody loves your charts and graphs. What's going on here? Needless to say, since October, we had a really big move down in oil prices, and we've retraced, I don't know, about half of that so far, back up in the mid-50s. Just today, as we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon, it was another big inventory day, and prices are up to, I think, a cycle high, 58.35 as we're speaking. What's going on here?
Well, that's a good question, Eric. So what's going on here is, I think, we're seeing the effect of reduction in Saudi exports to the United States. And so today's inventory draw was large, considering that we're in crude oil restocking season. So ordinarily at this time of year, we ought to have about a 4 million barrel add, and instead we had about a 4 million barrel draw. So that resulted in a big change in comparative inventory, and that's what's going on. So the Saudis are engineering, manipulating, if you will, our inventory level for us, and their expectation, of course, is that this is going to result in a appreciable increase in oil price. I don't see that as being the likely outcome, but I applaud them for trying. I mean, this is what you have to do. If you want oil prices to go up, you got to get the biggest consumer in the world to draw down his inventories. That's what's going on. But like I say, the big picture always has to be held firmly in focus. And the big picture is that the world is oversupplied with oil. We have been oversupplied with oil for all of 2018 or most of it, and we remain so. And all of the efforts that are being taken by OPEC Plus, mostly in this case, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Russia, they need to be done. But I don't think that, at least for the relatively near term, that they're going to change the fact that the world is oversupplied with oil. So as a simple executive summary, that's where we're at.
Art, I want to pick up on that subject of the market being oversupplied and getting more oversupplied. U.S. production has been increasing, but I've been watching both U.S. production, which actually finally downticked after a whole bunch of increases. It was down just one little tick this week to 12 million barrels even, still biggest producer on earth. So, we're really producing a lot of oil. A lot of people are expecting that to continue. And as I've been watching, I noticed that on one hand, the rig count is starting to roll over and it's not increasing. And of course, production tends to lag the rig count. But I remember in some previous interviews, you've told us that rig count is not really as relevant as it used to be, because the number of rigs and the number of wells being drilled isn't always the same. So should we be concerned about the rig count rolling off and maybe that not adding more production? Or is there more than meets the eye to this picture?
That's a really important question, Eric, and let me be clear if I've been less than clear in the past. Rig count always matters. I mean, the most relevant use of rig count is it tells you where capital expenditures are being allocated, if nothing else. So that's relevant. But the obvious connection is if you reduce the rate of drilling, eventually you're going to reduce the rate of production. Nothing about modern technology is going to change the fundamental physics of that relationship. So having said that, or those two things, yes, the rig count, and when we talk about rig count in the United States, I mean, let's face it, we're really talking about the Permian Basin. I mean, I track all the other plays, whether they're conventional or unconventional, but the Permian Basin is the big one. And yes, indeed, the number of rigs on tight oil plays has been going down, and the Permian has flattened out, I guess you could say. But the lag issue that you mentioned in your question is key, and maybe surprising to some, certainly surprising to me when I first worked this out, the lag between a rig going on a location and oil coming out of the well in the Permian Basin is a shocking 7 months. Now, some of that, of course, is taken up in the drilling, but a lot of that is got to do with drilling multiple wells on the same pad and not actually getting around to completing those wells until all the various well bores on the pad are done being drilled. And so there's a very great lag of, like I said, you know, something on the order of 7 months average for the tight oil plays. So what that says is that even though the rig count is flattening or possibly even rolling over, that says you got at least 7 months, or, you know, bracket that a little bit if you like, 6 or 8 months or something like that, before we're going to see the effect of that reduction in rigs. And then the next question you have to ask is, well, is that flattening or reduction enough to really make a difference? And the answer is no, it's not. I mean, we have to see a substantial decline before the production starts to come off. So in summary, yes, rig count matters. No, not everybody understands how to use it. I understand, I think, how to use it, which is you got to lag it and you got to lag it appropriately. And finally, the rig count will affect the production in the Permian Basin and in general, but not for a while. So that's the point, that we can do all these production cuts, you know, by Saudi Arabia, Russia, Canada, Venezuela, whomever, for reasons intended or unintended. And there's always a lag. And as long as the Permian Basin keeps cranking out the oil, all you're really doing is slowing the rate of rise is what's happening, as opposed to actually reducing the supply of oil to the world.
Now, speaking of people opining on things which they may or may not be expert on, the Wall Street Journal had an article recently which got a lot of attention in the investment community, although I don't think it really said anything that was news to the oil industry. And it was essentially that the trend toward packing more and more wells into less acreage is going to result in dramatically lower production rates for the new wells coming online. Is there truth to that? And should investors be concerned about it? How does that affect the whole picture?
There's obviously some truth to almost anything that sticks. I mean, that's a, you know, just a truism, I suppose. The weakness in that argument is the assumption that all of those wells are producing from the exact same reservoir. And so the first point that I'll make is that if you've got a great well, I don't care if it's a shale well or a conventional well, I don't care what it is. If you've got a better than average well, that means that you, for whatever reason, have a larger than average drainage area around that well. And so if you drill a second well on a general assumption that all the drainage areas are the same and this one's bigger, then you drill a second well and you're essentially drilling an unnecessary well. You're drilling a well into reservoir that might have been fully drained by the one existing well. And so basically what you're doing by drilling a second well is you're accelerating the rate which the oil is removed. What the Wall Street Journal article doesn't really get into, two things. The first is, what if one of those wells is drilled into a bed at, you know, at level A, and the second well is into a bed or a formation that's 200 feet below it? If they're draining different reservoirs, then the argument is null. It doesn't matter. And that is going on right now in a lot of these plays, that operators are drilling stacked reservoirs. So right away there's a qualification. But the second issue is, it depends on the well spacing. If the play is relatively mature, which is to say that you've pretty much drilled it on optimal well spacing, whatever that is, and let's just say for argument's sake that's putting laterals, say, 1,000 feet apart from each other, and you start drilling on reduced spacing, then the argument that they're making is absolutely true. You're interfering. You're you're draining area that would have already been drained by the pre-existing wells. The issue in the Permian Basin is that, surprisingly, most of the plays, certainly in the western area, the Delaware Basin, so-called, they're not anywhere near drilling those on any sort of optimal spacing yet. We got a long way to go. They're not as mature as the Bakken and the Eagle Ford. So while the statement or the assumption in the Wall Street Journal article is generically true, we're just not there yet. So it depends on what the level of maturity is. Bottom line, it was a good article, and investors should be aware, they should have been aware a long time ago, that more wells is not necessarily better, but that's not the pitch they were getting. So if all it does is wake them up to the fact that the less money you spend, the more money you'll make, then that's good. But I do think that in the case of the Permian, it's probably not an issue yet.
Returning to slide 2 in the deck and your overview slides here, of course, with today's action, the WTI price is almost $2 higher than what you have shown on this chart. Are we on the way to a retrace all the way back to October prices in the mid-70s, or do you think that maybe this bounce is not going to last? What's the high-level overview before we move on to the inventory numbers?
Obviously, I'm guessing here, but since you're asking me to speculate, I don't think it's going to last. I mean, this is a short-term reaction, as storage numbers always are. This is today. Tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, markets are going to rethink the reality of the situation, and probably we're going to go back down. But the bottom line, Eric, is that using this comparative inventory approach, WTI has been a couple of dollars undervalued for the last several weeks. So if it goes up a dollar or two and even stays there, that's fine. That's where it ought to be. So what happened is from mid-August through October, the markets went berserk on sentiment. Everybody was scared to death that we weren't going to have enough supply. And, you know, fair enough. I mean, sentiment isn't always misplaced. And that drove prices something like 20% higher than they should have been based on comparative inventory yield curve approach. Okay, so then everybody realized, well, okay, you know, these sanctions on Iran are not going to be, you know, as crushing as we thought. They're granting waivers, et cetera. And so then things overshot in the other direction. And we went, you know, 15 or 20% below the value that should have been. And since then, things have been working their way back to approximately where they ought to be. So I can't say what the market will do because I don't know the factors that will drive its sentiment. But my sense is, no, we're not going back to, you know, the $70, $71, $72 a barrel, at least not, you know, on any kind of a sustained basis. We might get there for a week or two if people freak out. But I think markets right now are extremely conscious of the fact that the global economy isn't looking as good as we thought it might be looking, say, back in September. And that's going to be a continual weight on the ability of oil prices to move consistently higher. People aren't forgetting about that, nor are people ignorant of the fact that all of the major forecasting agencies, whatever you think about their forecasts, EIA, IEA, OPEC, they're all saying we're oversupplied. You know, those are factors that are all integrated into the longer term, which is to say, you know, more than a week or two, estimate of where the market's going to go.
Let's go ahead and move into the comparative inventory information on slide 3 then. Why don't you talk us through these charts and tell us what has developed since the last time we talked to you?
Well, what's developed is in some ways more of the same, certainly on the WTI side of things. And on the Brent side, what's developed is what I believe is a fairly substantial devaluation of the marginal barrel of Brent. And so if we look at slide number 3, the graph on the left is WTI. And as I just talked you through, You can see there's a there are two fairly large red dots and a black arrow on the left-hand side. Those are the high points of oil price. And you can see there's a, you know, but when you get over to that September $71, you're way above the blue line, which is the yield curve, which is approximately where all this data says we should be. Then we went way down below that in December, and now we've worked our way back up to it. And I don't have, of course, the charts for today with the latest integrated data, but at $58, we're right on track. We're right on the yield curve. We're exactly where the yield curve says price ought to be. The bad news, if you're an oil bull, is that that yield curve is pretty flat. So if you compare its slope moving off to the left-hand side of the graph to the red slope, the red yield curve, which was 2014 to 17, that one is a lot steeper. Okay, and those different slopes reflect the market's sense of urgency about getting more wells drilled. So the blue slope, the one we're on now, market's saying, you know what, we care a little bit more than we did before if inventories are going down, but we don't feel the pain yet. And so what that means is that you can move comparative inventory down a lot and you don't raise price by very much. And I want to emphasize before I talk about the one on the right what some of the words in this slide say, and that is the price collapse we saw in October through December was not an adjustment. This was not some super superfluous event that ended and now it's over and we're back to where things were. This was a very substantial and significant structural change in the way that the market values oil. And that is not going to go away. We're not resetting to where we were before all that happened. That was an event every bit as significant as the 2014-15 oil price collapse. And people would say, well, wait a minute. You know, the price of oil, you know, went from $100 to $50 in that case, and we didn't see anything like this. Well, if you actually compare the rates of change, how much price came off every day, if you look at the percent of change, you'll see that, in fact, it was in the same order of magnitude. And for those who care to look, in the slide deck that I showed up in Vancouver, I've got tables in one of the slides that actually shows that. So what happened there is that this blue yield curve developed for WTI beginning sometime back in actually mid-2017. Brent stayed kind of on the same higher, steeper, more urgent trajectory until this oil price collapse in 18. And what you can see looking at the graph on the right, you can see the bright red dot, which says September, $79, and right next to it, October. So those were the high oil prices. They were falling just below the red yield curve. And then all of a sudden, November, the orange dot is way down below. December, the blue dot is even farther below. January kind of moves to the sideways, and February moved up a lot, so or a little bit. So what's happened is that Brent has gone through the same devaluation process just here in the last few months that WTI did a year and a half ago. And so the light blue dashed line on the right-hand graph, which I say 2019 yield curve question mark, it's a little early to say with any kind of authority that that's where we're going, but that's where I think we're going. What does that mean? That means that Brent has been adjusted downward like 20% since September. And I'm saying I think it's probably going to stay somewhere in that range. So again, urgency, that slope is flat. It's as flat as the WTI slope. So you can pull a whole lot of oil out of inventory, drop comparative inventory a bunch, and you're not going to get back to $70 Brent for a long time. You're going to have to really, really draw down inventory to get there. Therefore, what these two graphs and this very important slide say is if any of this is reasonable, and I think it is, when people tell you, oh yeah, you know, Brent's going to be back to $90 and WTI is going to be at $80, $85, something real fundamentally structurally different is going to have to happen for that to go on. We're going to have to throw all this away. We're going to have to break through these rules like we did the past ones, which could happen. But based on this, I'm saying, you know, I think that both WTI and Brent are going to slowly increase, but I don't think that we're going to see Brent above much above 70 and WTI much above of 60. And by the way, not that it matters, but I mean, that's the view of EIA, and see what IEA has to say when they come out with their next report. But those agencies and OPEC are saying, yeah, we're going to have real low oil prices for 2019, and I agree.
And just for the benefit of anyone listening who may not yet be familiar with the concept of what these yield curves depict conceptually and what all the dots mean, again, Art's prior interviews, if you put in Art Berman at the search box on macrovoices.com, you can find a full description of the comparative inventory system. Let's move on to slide 4, production surplus. Why don't we first define what we mean by a production surplus and then talk about what this chart's telling us?
Sure. A production surplus just says that when I take the world's production and subtract the world's consumption, what's left is either a production surplus or a production deficit. So if consumption is less than production, I got a surplus. And so some people might be saying, well, isn't that the same as supply and demand? And the answer is, it's close, but it's not quite the same. But for right now, if you want to think about it that way, fair enough. Just remember, it's not quite the same. What this is saying, though, is what I've done is I've said, look, I don't necessarily believe in forecasts, although I'm sure glad somebody does them. I don't criticize forecasts like a lot of people in our business do because they're wrong. Of course, a forecast is going to be wrong. But what I've done here is, instead of showing you every quarter production surplus, production deficit, I've chosen some kind of secular trends that I've identified, and I've averaged through those. So, you know, so for instance, the large blue block in the middle of the graph that says production surplus, that's the third quarter of 2014 through the fourth quarter of 2016. And the average surplus across all that period of time of, you know, like 2 years is 820,000 barrels per day. It's a pretty healthy surplus. Look at the blue curve, which is Brent price, and guess what? You got too much oil, price got real low. And similarly for the production deficit that shows up right after that, which is all of 2017 through the middle of 18. Yeah, price went up because we actually were consuming a little bit more than we produced. We've now moved into a period from beginning in the third quarter of 2018, where up until now, and the black line is real, and everything to the right is forecast, but we're back into a surplus. It's not the same magnitude of surplus as we saw in 2014-16. It's 450 or so thousand barrels a day, still worth paying attention to. But more importantly, and this is notional because we don't know the future, but our anticipation, or the IEA, EIA, OPEC data that I've used to develop this, is saying, yeah, the situation is going to persist probably at about the same level through about 2020. So that's all pretty significant. If you want to believe the hype about oil prices going up a lot, well, you've got to square it with this. You've got to square it with the fact that all the best analysis that we can do about the future suggests that we're going to be oversupplied for the next almost 2 years. And if you still think oil prices are going to go up, well, more power to you. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that, you know, you've got to calibrate your expectations with something real, and that's what this is all about.
Well, and I think a related subject, although it's very, very early in this story, is finally maybe we're seeing a turning point for Venezuela, and that certainly doesn't mean they're going to be producing a lot of oil next month, but if things turn around for the country, that is the most oil-rich nation on Earth. And, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, if they go back to producing 4 million barrels a day, that really makes a big difference. Do the forecasts that we see here reflect expectations about situations like Venezuela, or do they only reflect current production in facilities that are actually working?
No, Eric, it's the former. And again, you know, it's easy to criticize forecasts because the guys that make them know they're going to be wrong. But the people that do these forecasts at all of those three agencies, these are smart people, very sophisticated, knowledgeable people with extremely sophisticated software. Now, having said all that, I'm not endorsing it and saying believe it. I'm just saying respect it. So these guys are thinking through, they're thinking ahead. The title of this particular graph says EIA revised production surplus 170,000 barrels a day lower. Well, that's based on the lay of the short-term energy outlook that was published on Tuesday, okay, yesterday, compared to a month ago. So on the one hand, you say, well, see, they were wrong. Okay, but so what they're doing is they're saying, you know what? In the month that's passed, we've seen that OPEC, Saudi Arabia in particular, has been extremely aggressive in their production cuts and their targeted exports. And we now think that's going to have a bigger influence going forward. So that production surplus has shrunk from about 600,000 barrels a day to about 450,000 barrels a day. So that's evidence that this is a dynamic process and the modelers are trying their best to accommodate. Now you mentioned Venezuela. Yeah, of course, Venezuela's oil is mostly heavy. And we're in short supply on heavy oil, so that's important. But it's also important to understand that, you know, just because Venezuela starts producing 4 million barrels a day again doesn't mean that there's necessarily going to be a market because others have stepped into that breach, like Canada, for instance. But I think a more immediate factor to consider is Libya. Libya's production is back up over 1 million barrels a day. Nobody's talking much about Libya right now because we're all focused on Venezuela and, you know, the Alberta production caps and all that stuff. But Libya is a huge oil producer. And through most of the last couple of years, they've been under, you know, these refineries and pipelines have been under attack by rebels and all sorts of civil unrest. And now we're hearing that, you know, General Haftar appears to have finally gotten the upper hand. Now, if Libya continues to produce 1 million barrels a day or more, that changes things today, not in 4 or 5 years. And I think we're seeing that. And, you know, we'll get to a slide here in a few minutes that shows the change in OPEC spare capacity. And despite all the cuts, their spare capacity was flat this month. It didn't increase with all the cuts, and I think that's got a lot to do with Libya's production coming back strong for now. That could all end tomorrow, as we've seen many times in the past several years.
Let's go ahead and move on then to slide 5. A lot of people are saying that OPEC doesn't matter anymore, that OPEC no longer has the ability to control the oil price the way they used to, although certainly the price responds to their statements. Tell us what you've got on the graph here on slide 5.
This is an incremental chart, and I do incremental because it makes changes much more obvious. It doesn't in any way corrupt the data. So all I've done here is I've just taken the minimum amount, smallest amount of OPEC spare capacity and subtracted it from all the monthly values, added it back into the number, which is called the base. So what this chart shows is that spare capacity was relatively high in 2017, 2018, which is to say that those countries were producing less. And that resulted in Brent price climbing from, you know, whatever it was, up to, you know, from the spring of 2017 all the way up to $80 a barrel or so for a brief period in October 18. So OPEC spare capacity goes down and price changes. They reversed that process in November, and they started adding production, and the price collapsed. So I think the point of this is that people want to project their disdain and their kind of their anger at OPEC and say, oh, they don't matter anymore. But, you know, and I'm not endorsing OPEC and not a supporter of or a detractor from them. All I'm saying is that when OPEC cuts production, the price goes up. And when OPEC adds production, the price goes down. And if people don't want to acknowledge that, well, that's great. You know, go ahead. But I say that what OPEC does matters. Now, what is true is that because, you know, was a time when you know, OPEC was a much more substantial supplier in the sense that before the shale revolution, so-called, there wasn't a lot of extra production that could be called on outside of OPEC. That's changed. So it is true that OPEC can't have its way in terms of making prices move from some, say, relatively low level to $20 a barrel higher. I mean, it used to be if OPEC said we're cutting production, the price of WTI would jump 10 bucks. Now when they say it, you know, maybe it goes up a dollar. So that's the market acknowledging that there's a much broader diversity of supply than there used to be. So in that sense, OPEC isn't as strong as it used to be. It only says, okay, they can't radically change the price of oil, but by changing the supply, they can certainly change the percentage up and down quite a bit. So that's the only point. If you look at the last two dots on the spare capacity, their cuts had moved spare capacity up to 2.1 million barrels a day in January, and it hadn't moved in February, and that's because of Libya coming on. If Libya hadn't come back on, then spare capacity would have increased quite a bit more, and which is to say production from OPEC would have gone down and price might have gone up higher than it has rebounded since the first of the year.
Moving on to slide 6, Art, we're looking at U.S. output, and I'm curious what your overall view is, because this is something I've been pondering a lot. It seems to me like, you know, the rig count is starting to level off. We're already at 12 million barrels. Is there really an incentive for the industry to, you know, try to get to 14 million barrels, or are we going to see a leveling off of this huge increase in production that's occurred in the United States in the last few years?
Yeah, that's the right question to ask, Eric. And the answer is no one knows. But the chart on the left goes out through the end of 2020. So this is EIA's forecast. And so what EIA is telling us here is that they believe that production will flatten out sometime in the spring, maybe in another couple of months, say May. It'll stop growing, flatten out, maybe decline a little bit, and then, you know, well out into same thing they see happening again in 2020. It'll grow a little bit in early 2020, then flatten out. So I think this chart is reflecting the fact that, no, we can't continue to grow. And it's an open question. Is it an economic incentive that says we're not going to? Or are there actual limits on U.S. production growth? And I'm going to vote for the latter. I mean, I don't think it's a bottomless pit by any means. And, you know, in Vancouver and elsewhere, I've taken substantial issue with the kind of production forecast that EIA has done for the tight oil plays and the Permian Basin. I just think I just don't understand how they can possibly support those things. But again, I respect them. So whatever. But the answer to your question is it's going to slow, and it probably will decline. And that was the crux of the discussion we had in the beginning about the rig count falling off. I mean, it's got to have an effect. So you could say, well, you know, production in February actually fell a little bit. Is that the beginning of all of this? And the answer is, well, okay, maybe. But the graph on the right is showing year over year. And so what we're seeing a decline in the growth rate. That doesn't mean we're seeing a decline in growth. So February was 1.6 million barrels a day more than in February a year ago. I mean, that's huge. that's a tremendous increase. And so what these two charts say overall is that we're not going to grow at the rate that we have, but we're going to continue to grow. That's the message that I take out of here.
This was, of course, a discussion about U.S. production. Let's move on to world production on slide 7. What are these charts telling us?
World production is telling us a slightly more comforting story if the goal is less overproduction. So world production has declined 1.75 million barrels a day since October. Now, important point, U.S. production was crude oil and condensate. World production is liquids. Okay, so they're not exactly likes to likes. And of course, liquids includes all kinds of stuff like natural gas liquids, like biofuels, and a lot of other stuff. But still, there is clearly a decline going on in world liquids production. But look at the year over year on the right, the chart in with the nice greens and golds. It's a fairly substantial change, more substantial change in the rate of growth. But we still added 1.2 million barrels a day more in February than we did February a year ago. So the message from these two slides, 6 and 7, the message is we're slowing down, but we're still oversupplied and we're still producing a whole lot more oil this last month than we did a year ago at the same time. So we got a ways to go to reduce the oversupply.
Moving on to slide 8, a subject near and dear to my heart, forward curves. What are you looking at here?
Yeah, well, what I'm looking at, Eric, is that Brent and WTI seem to be going in really, really different directions. And this is not anything that, developed a week ago. And so the big picture, when you look at both of these, WTI's on the left and Brent is on the right, is that WTI is in pretty darn respectful contango out through the end of 2019, and then it moves off into backwardation. So that's not a good signal if you expect to see WTI price rise very much at all. Looking over at the graph on the right of Brent, we see pretty much exactly the opposite. That the latest curve on the right, and they're both red, March 8th in both cases. March 8th Brent curve is in, pretty strong to moderate backwardation right out of the gate, prompt month. And that persists all the way through the end of this year and then goes into even stronger backwardation. So these two sets of forward curves, that go from beginning of January and not exactly every week, but just showing the highlights, they're saying that apparently, demand for Brent is viewed by the market as more urgent than demand for WTI, and that doesn't surprise me at all. This is a market signal, and the issue there is that WTI is light oil, and the world doesn't need light oil as much as it does the intermediate grades that represent Brent that you can stick right into a refinery without having to blend and do all kinds of other stuff. So I think that's an important message. Oil quality matters. And I think that's what's being said here. There's also an issue with supply. The market's telling the U.S., slow down, you guys, cool it. We're going to put you in contango until you get the message. But I think the stronger issue is oil quality, with a secondary issue being supply.
And, of course, sentiment in oil markets can be measured by outstanding long and short positions that exist in the futures market. Moving on to slide 9, what are we looking at on these charts here?
Right. So the one on the left, the blue and the gold, that is a combined Brent WTI. So we're looking at long and short in blue and gold, and then net long in the yellow curve. And the right-hand curve is WTI. And here we're looking at net long in the blue and WTI in the red, but the price in the red. But the point of these is that for both net long and long short, et cetera, for Brent and WTI. Those positions dropped way off as prices slowly declined and then collapsed towards the end of last year. And now they're coming back. They're moving back up, which, you know, if you don't look too carefully at it, is an optimistic signal. Contrast that with what we're seeing on the, in the slide on the right. Now, these are normalized net long positions. They're normalized by open interest. And what we see is that net long positions on WTI have just about collapsed, and they're not coming back. And I emphasize that with the black line showing the average 2018 net long and the average 2019 net long. And so the net longs in 2019 are 93% lower than they were in 18. So again, for the bulls on the WTI side, not that, you know, managed money rules all, but it's a, you know, it's an indicator of how the market feels. It's an indicator of market sentiment. I'd say that the market isn't feeling too good about WTI right now. In fact, that's about, I mean, you're very close to zero. I mean, you're really, really low there. Now, I said, if you don't look too carefully at the Brent WTI, and what I meant by that is, yeah, the, you know, these are two markets combined, so it's always a little bit confusing. But what I take away from this is that the we're adding more shorts, okay? The net longs are increasing, but for a couple of weeks there, it was all longs, and the shorts were coming off, or at least staying even. And now what we're seeing are people are starting to increase their short bets on Brent plus WTI. So again, that's just reflecting kind of a doubtful caution by the markets that Brent is actually going to go up that much too.
And of course, these are measures of investor sentiment as to where people are positioned in the market. Moving on to slide 10, we're looking at the Brent WTI spread. What are these charts telling us?
Well, this gets back to oil quality to a large extent and somewhat lesser extent to supply. So the chart on the left, what we're looking at here is the Brent premium to WTI, just the difference between the two futures prices on a weekly basis. And what we see is that that premium got up to a maximum in late October, went pretty darn high again in mid-February. It's dropped off a little bit. But overall, that premium is staying in well above the five-year average, which is shown in the red curve. What that says to me is that markets are recognizing that WTI, because of its light nature, the fact that you can't make a lot of diesel out of it, is just not as valuable. It's just not as useful. That we need Brent more than we're willing to pay more for Brent than we're willing to pay for WTI. That's what it says. And the graph on the right is really just kind of, you know, taking the same information. It's taking the positive Brent premium compared to the five-year average, which is the blue, and the negative Brent premium versus the five-year average, and putting it in gold. And so you can just sort of see it more graphically. And of course, the standout feature of this chart is what it says, tight oil development, when the Brent premium got up to almost $25 per barrel over WTI way back in 2011. I don't think we're going to see a repeat of that, but the point is that ever since really early in 2018, that preference, that sense of greater demand and therefore higher price for Brent has remained quite strong. So oil quality, I think, is the message of these two charts.
Moving on to slide 11, the Permian Basin has been really the engine of growth for U.S. oil production. But you're saying that the production may decline in coming months. How does that jibe with the EIA forecast for increasing production through 2020 overall?
I'd love to have somebody from EIA on this call with us, Eric, because I don't know how to answer that. But so my sense of it is that EIA just takes production and they think of reasons why it shouldn't increase at the rate that it has been. And it has been on a tear for several years now. And they're just assuming for some reason that it can keep on going up. Well, okay, fine. I'm a little bit more objective and live in the real world. And what I've done, and let's look at the graph on the right first, because maybe it's easier. What I've shown here is production in green. And yeah, it's been going to the moon. That rate of increase in 2017-18 is just astonishing. But I'm going beyond the rig count here a little bit, and I'm showing new producing wells, okay? So you drill a well, and then you got to bring it on production. I told you about the rig count and how there's a lag and all that. So I'm showing the new producing wells, because rigs don't produce oil. Wells do. People seem to forget that. And what we're seeing is that the number of new producing wells added each month is actually declining on a quarterly basis. That's what that shows. Okay, that's a real good indication that production is going to have to at least flatten in response to that. And there's a million arguments. Well, you know, the newer wells have higher IPs, you know, higher initial rates, and you're averaging older production with newer. Nonetheless, you know, just as a fundamental benchmark, if you're adding fewer wells, eventually the production is going to come down. Now, the graph on the left looks simple enough. It's kind of complicated. What I've done there is I've taken the rig count, which is in blue, and that's absolute. Anybody can reproduce that curve. And what it's showing is what you noted in the beginning of the conversation, which is that the rig count, the blue line, is climbing at a very, very slow rate, may have actually turned over a little bit here in the last full month of data that we had here, which is January 19. Then I've lagged production back by 7 months so that I can get a match between the two. And what that says is that if you believe there's a correlation between the two, and I do, then that says that we're going to see production mimic the flattening or the slower rate of growth in the rig count. And as I said in the beginning, when should we expect that? Well, it's going to be a while. It's going to be 6 or 7 months. But it all just goes to show that eventually market forces do rule. And for as enthusiastic as we want to be about the production potential of the Permian Basin, eventually investors are going to, they're going to put their foot down and say, look, guys, we're not going to give you any more money unless you start making some money for us. So that's an important message. That's not something I think you ordinarily get from the Wall Street Journal. And I read the Wall Street Journal every day, so I'm not disparaging them at all. But this takes a little bit deeper digging.
And in the humor department, will capital discipline finally be imposed on U.S. E&P companies? I got a feeling I know the answer, but go ahead. Tell us what slide 12 is about.
Well, slide 12 is an attempt to show that there's a school of thought out there that says that that the investment community is abandoning placements and of equity and bond purchases for the shale plays. And yeah, I agree that that's what the data shows. But I've been wrong so many times in the past. When I thought, okay, this is finally the day of reckoning and the capital enablers are going to cut them off, and they never do. Something always happens. These guys are smart. They're resourceful. So, you know, just to kind of make this real simple, every couple of months, there's a thread in the industry. So, okay, now it's finally going to happen. My point is it never does. And if it does, that'll be great. But I'll believe it when it happens. So I think that the expectation of capital discipline, if the capital discipline comes, it will not be because the companies decide to get good. It's going to be because investors stop giving them money. That's the essence of slide number 12.
Moving on to slide 13, let's talk a little bit about growth, not in the shale patch, but conventional and offshore development.
Yeah, this is real important, and we don't see a lot of press on this. This is some data from Rystad Energy, and what they're showing here is that we have a tremendous amount of proved reserves offshore whose development was put on hold during the period of low oil prices. Well, that's all starting to change, and the big companies are going back in. And if you look at the newly sanctioned projects that are scheduled for 2019, if this comes to pass, That's 46 billion barrels of oil equivalent that's already been found. This is not exploratory work that the big companies in the offshore plan to develop. So, you know, you start to say, well, it's looking hopeful. The shale plays might be cooling it a little bit for a variety of reasons. OPEC is certainly cutting back a lot, reducing exports. So maybe we're going to get back in balance. And then I said, well, yeah, but then there's Libya. Well, yeah, but maybe even more significantly, you know, the deep water is the big supply engine, has been for a long time. And the proved reserves out there, you know, they kind of went on hold for several years. And if we go out and develop, you know, let's say even half of the 46 billion barrels of oil equivalent over the next couple of years, that's just going to add to the oversupply. You know, you got to keep the big picture in mind.
And finally, on slide 14, it looks like the cost of drilling as well as completing wells is increasing along with oil prices. What's going on in this final chart?
Well, I think it's called oil field services. Oil field services have been in survival mode since the oil price collapsed. They've been giving out their work at a loss just to have cash flow. And many of the bold claims of cutting costs by the E&P companies, as I've said in many interviews with you, Eric, some of it's real, but most of it is just a depression in the oil field service companies. So people that think that costs are going to continue to go down need to look at this graph. This is producer price index for drilling oil and gas wells. This isn't Art Berman here. This is the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank who keep track of these costs. And what they're showing is that those costs dropped 42% from the time that oil prices collapsed until late in 2016. And since then, they've increased 20%. So the oil field service companies, the Schlumbergers, the Halliburtons, et cetera, they're now saying, okay, you know, you guys are getting a higher price, so time for us to get our higher price too. What's that mean? All it means is that don't believe the prices go down forever. They don't. And this is a standard business cycle. And as the costs go up, unless prices go up correspondingly, that means that the companies are going to be making less profit. So again, just trying to put the whole picture into perspective. So, you know, the big picture that we want to preserve from all of this is that the world is oversupplied with oil, probably will remain oversupplied for much of, if not most of, 2019, possibly into 2020. Let's temper our expectations of higher oil prices with that big oversupply issue, with the fact that we've got comparative inventory data that says even if we draw down reserves a lot, that the market sense of urgency is relatively low, which means that prices will increase, but they probably won't increase as spectacularly as people think. The big variables in the equation on supply other than OPEC, it's shale, and it's also deep water. Let's not forget this. We haven't talked about it much over the last couple of years. Big source of proved reserves. All you got to do is go out and develop them. And if wells are costing more to develop by 20%, then that means that it's going to be harder for the E&P companies to deliver a profit. So that's the big picture message that I want people to try to understand as they weigh all this daily and weekly information, some of which seems like noise.
Well, Art, we've run a little bit over time, but I didn't want to cut you off because it's such great content. Before we let you go, though, I want to mention to our listeners, you have a blog at artberman.com, which is absolutely free. It's probably one of the very best free investment information resources I know of anywhere in the world. So, folks, if you're interested in the oil market and you haven't already subscribed for free at artberman.com, you're crazy not to do so. In the meantime, Art, I didn't even realize on some of our past interviews, you also have a paid service that goes beyond what the blog offers. Tell us a little bit about that, what's on offer, and where people can find out more about it.
Right. Well, so the best way to get through to that is on the website, artberman.com. There's a big button up at the top called Contact. As you know, Eric, I've shied away from advertising even myself on my website, but I've got a whole range of services from a weekly newsletter, a monthly newsletter, all the way up to a premium service, which includes this kind of content and more, including phone time and consulting time with me. So you can get the low end of my services for a couple hundred dollars a month. The high end, get into the couple of thousand dollars a month. But whatever suits you, there's a lot more underneath the hood than just the blogs and the tweets, which are, you know, if you know how to put them together, an awful lot of it's there, but most people don't.
Well, we look forward to having you back on the program soon. In the meantime, we encourage everyone to follow you on Twitter. Let everyone know your Twitter handle before we say goodbye.
It's at AEBerman12.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Art. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Art back on the show. You know, I really enjoyed the fact that he took a dive into looking at those Brent forward curves, and also the fact that he touched on the commitment of trader reports and the positioning of traders on the long and short side of the markets, that kind of stuff that I more enjoy when it comes to trading oil. Now, one of the interesting things, when he touched on this, the curves and the fact that WTI is trading in clear contango, some prominent oil traders that I've been listening to have been talking about the fact that the spread between Brent and WTI can continue to widen. I mean, let me just have a quick look here. But yeah, we're like at $9 or something like that right now in the spread between WTI and Brent. But, you know, when Art was showing that one chart, there was a time back in like 2011, 2012 when the spread blew out to being $25 wide. Is this a real possibility in your mind?
No, I don't think it is. And the reason is in 2011, when the spread was that wide, the export of U.S. crude oil was illegal. So to arbitrage that spread, in other words, to take U.S. oil, you don't actually have to put it on a ship and, you know, send it to London and unload it there and sell it again into the Brent contract to arbitrage it. There's an effective arbitrage that occurs just in the sense that there are more people around the world who could either buy Brent oil or buy WTI, because either way they have to ship it to Asia, and they're buying WTI now, and that's the reason that we have record exports of up to 3.5 million barrels per day of crude oil leaving the United States via export. That changes the dynamics completely. So I don't think it's relevant to look at what happened before the legalization of U.S. crude exports, because there were just different fundamental factors in the market. Now, at the same time, it is possible for the differences that exist between Brent and WTI to cause that spread to widen even more. My understanding of it, though, and you know, this is subjective stuff. A lot of people have different opinions. So my opinion is not necessarily right, but it, to me, is the most credible version of several different opinions that I've heard from different people over the years. I think this is mostly about physical logistics of the delivery point for WTI is in Cushing, Oklahoma, which the way things used to work way back in the old days is all the oil came into the United States through Houston, and it went through a pipeline from Houston up to Cushing to supply the distribution center and the storage tanks in Cushing. These days, it works the other way. Most of the oil comes down from Canada in a pipeline into Cushing, and now they've reversed the Seaway pipeline that used to go from the Texas Gulf Coast up to Cushing. Now it goes the other way, from Cushing down to the Gulf Coast. So what I think is driving this difference is, in order to arbitrage the Cushing oil price and the Brent oil price, if you really wanted to do a full-on arbitrage where you go and buy something in one market and physically move it and sell it in another market, you'd have to get the oil pipelined out of Cushing down to the Gulf Coast, then onto a tanker, then over and so forth. And the reason I feel so confident that this description is right is if you look at Louisiana Light Sweet, which is similar to WTI, but on the Gulf Coast. It's a Louisiana delivery point on the ocean where it could be loaded into a tanker as opposed to landlocked in Cushing, Oklahoma. It's basically the same grade of oil, and there's a pretty big price difference just because of its physical location. So I think delivery logistics are what's driving this. Now, that doesn't mean that the problem can't get worse. As we have more and more demand for these exports of U.S. oil, which is a hugely important trend, you need more and more pipeline capacity to get the oil from the Permian down to the Gulf Coast and onto a ship and export it. If you start having to compete with oil coming from Canada, they're both waiting for the same pipeline, now that starts to widen that spread even more. But I think it has more to do with delivery logistics than it does with, you know, different grades of oil or where the users are and so forth. I think it has to do with what it costs to get the oil from where it is to where it's needed.
Well, you know, with that question, though, how do you think the contango plays out in that market? I mean, how should I, as a trader, I read into the fact that the contango in WTI isn't in the Brent oil market?
Oh, well, that one is very clear to me, but I will qualify my opinion first to say it is my opinion. Some people have different views. I think it's entirely about the market discounting the cost of storage. The reason WTI is fundamentally different from Brent is that WTI has a delivery point in Cushing, Oklahoma, which is a storage facility. The only way the people that operate the storage facility make money is if there's contango in the market, because that gives them the carry on the oil that they have in storage. In other words, if they own physical oil and that's their long position and they own an equal number of short futures contracts, that gives them a market neutral weighting. So they're not taking any market risk. They're just storing the oil and delivering into that futures contract. If they can take the oil they have in storage and roll the futures contract forward each month, they capture that contango as their profit or their payment for storage. If there's no contango in the market, there's no incentive for anybody to store any oil. They deliver it into the market. It pushes the front month price down until there is contango. So what we saw this week with this inventory report is time spreads at the front of the curve over the next 6 to 9 months exploded to the upside. Why? Well, because during restocking season, when we should expect large builds on inventory, that's builds on inventory, which means somebody needs to get paid for storing that oil. Instead, we're getting huge drawdowns, which means there's less demand for storage. If there's less demand for storage, the price of storage has to come down. Where is the price of storage expressed? It's expressed in the shape of the term structure, how much contango exists at the front of the WTI forward curve. Why don't you see it in the Brent curve? Because Brent is a financially settled contract which doesn't have a delivery point and which doesn't have a storage facility associated with it. So that's the reason, in my mind, number one, that we had this huge contango at the front of the WTI curve, but not in the Brent curve. And number two, it's the reason that that contango collapsed dramatically this week is because the market was caught completely off guard by the size of these inventory drawdowns, both on crude oil and on finished products, in a week when the refineries are in their turnaround season, which means they're not consuming as much crude oil, and we would normally expect big builds on inventory this time of year. So storage expectations are being reset, and that contango is rapidly coming out of the market in the last couple of days. There have been huge moves in those time spreads.
You know, the one thing I wanted to touch on with you is the technical levels on oil, because I heard a number of traders talking about those November highs that came in around 57 on WTI as being where a lot of the highs could come in. But my numbers have always been targeting crude oil to make it potentially technically up to about the $60+ area. But I'm not bullish on crude oil beyond that. And I'm even debating the idea of whether that becomes a really interesting level to face crude oil off of. What's your thinking on that? Are you generally bearish crude, and what levels would you consider short selling it at?
Well, I had been bearish, I had been short, and of course I was stopped out of my short trade with this move. But really what has gone on in my mind is the fundamentals have changed. The story has changed. Now, is there really a trend here that's beginning of drawdowns? This big drawdown occurring during refinery maintenance season, during inventory restocking season, was really, really out of place. Now, quite frankly, this is government data. It could be they just screwed up and got the data wrong because they counted wrong. That happens with EIA, believe me. If this turns into a trend, though, of there being significant drawdowns at this time of year, and well, how could that possibly happen? The way it could happen is when you're exporting 3 million barrels a day, which used to be zero because it was illegal. Well, if you're sending great big huge ships out of the U.S. with U.S. drilled oil instead of the other direction like we used to, that changes the equation, doesn't it? If this turns into a trend of there being more inventory drawdowns, then that is a fundamental change in the fundamental outlook that just changes everything. People like me have to revisit our views. On the other hand, if what we find out is, okay, this was a little bit of a blip and we're going to go back to, you know, let's say maybe next week is a big build on inventory and we see more at least moderate-sized builds, which would be normal for this time of year, okay, then I think crude oil is done here because I think it's already overvalued on the basis of what the fundamentals were telling us before we got this inventory surprise, as well as what I think is a smaller component, which is the OPEC and the Venezuela and the Iran sanctions all hitting at the same time. Just a huge number of bullish inputs. And the way I look at it, frankly, is huge, huge, huge bullish inputs. And we got, what, the dollar up or something? I mean, not a whole lot. Dollar and a half. I think it might be that this contract is really tired and really wants to roll over and move down. But it's not going to move down if we keep getting big draws on inventory at a time of year when we should be getting builds.
All right. Well, let's move on, because at the start of the episode, you were talking about some of these different emails coming in on Charlie. First of all, what were these emails about? And more importantly, what clarification did you want to add to that?
Well, I was surprised. We got quite a few comments on Twitter and an email saying, boy, Charlie really blew it. You know, he said the market was going to go down and it's been the opposite way. Sorry, folks, that's not what he said. So I think we should just do a quick review and summary of what the outlook that Charlie described last week, because I really do think that he's onto something and that he's identified some important risks to understand. First of all, what he said is that seasonally speaking, we should expect equity prices to melt up into Friday's quad witching hour. That's tomorrow, March 15th, Friday quad witching hour. Historically, the records show us that we should expect equity prices to move up into that event and down out of it. Well, the fact that they've moved up into that event is precisely what Charlie forecast, so there should be no surprise there. Now, if they move down, the seasonal effect is not really tremendous. It's a little bit of down, but it's not a huge down. The risk that Charlie has identified is that if those seasonal factors, and perhaps there's some other bearish news that comes into the market, if they should cause equities to start selling off in the next several days, and particularly it's looking out into next week where the numbers really get interesting, and I'll review some of those numbers with you in just a minute. What happens is all of the algorithmic traders, the commodity trading advisors who trade stock index futures based on momentum and trend following models, there's always a line in the sand where if the price closes below such and such a level, they're going to start selling. And if it closes above such and such a level, they're going to start buying. Normally, those levels are well away from the market. But just because of the way that they get calculated, what Charlie's team has identified is that as we look out, and it's really 8 trading days into the future, so that'll be 7 trading days beyond Friday. So, you know, we're really looking at that point toward the very end of the month. What happens is those threshold levels that were all down in the low 2700s, they start moving up, and it's actually right around 4 days out. And this is from yesterday's email that I'm reading this, so that would be Tuesday or so. is when they move up from 27.41 to 27.75. Now, the market is well above 27.75. The point is, if that seasonal selling were to take us below 27.75 next week, it could trigger some algorithmic sellers. And that number moves up even more as we get about 8 or 9 days out. Then all of a sudden it's 27.89, and at one point it goes up to 27.90, 27.86, 27.86, 27.80. I'm looking at various different days here between 9 and 15 days out on the calendar. So the risk, it doesn't mean that Charlie is predicting that the market's going to crash. What he's saying is if other factors cause the price to drift back down to that, let's say, below 27.80 level over the next couple weeks, that would be a trigger that would cause the algorithmic traders to start selling, and things could really exacerbate themselves from there. Now, on the other hand, Charlie also said if it doesn't go that way, and we have, let's say there's some really bullish news, maybe we get a more credible announcement that there really and truly is a trade deal between the U.S. and China that's been agreed to, well, that could really start a melt-up, because if things go the other direction, the technicals are really there as we break past this high that we just had, which we've already done, and especially if we break to new all-time highs, those are major technical buying signals that are going to propel the market much higher. So it could be that there's a big move higher coming, could be that there's a big move lower. The point that Charlie made is understand that those trigger points where the CTAs start selling are going to move much closer to at-the-market levels over the next couple of weeks. And so if, that's a big IF with an underscore, if the market moves lower due to other factors, such as the seasonal tendency for the market to move lower coming out of quad witching hour, that maybe sets us up for a self-reinforcing vicious cycle of selling that could take us much lower. It's not a certainty. It's a possibility, and it's a risk to be aware of.
Yeah, you know, Eric, the one thing as a technician, a lot of people misinterpret technical analysis as being some magic forecasting tool that is always right. It's about identifying the behavior of markets and the direction many of the things can be influenced by the shift in behavior of investors at different levels. And so old Charlie, in my mind, is doing is identifying some of the trigger points where some of the behavior of investors can change.
You know, that is such an important point, Patrick. I remember when I first started learning technical analysis years ago, I completely understood what the whole point was. I thought the idea was these technical analysis techniques were going to teach me how to predict what the market's going to do. And it doesn't work that way. The way technical analysis works is it tells you where the forks in the road are likely to occur. If we get to this point and this happens, it's likely that it's going to continue or it's going to accelerate from there. If we're moving up, there's a resistance level. It doesn't mean it can't go beyond it. It means that's going to be where you make your decision. If it reverses at that point, well, that's why it's called resistance. If it doesn't reverse, it's probably going to accelerate. It's knowing where the turns in the road are and being ready to respond to them and knowing how to interpret the signals as the market gives you. It's not a crystal ball, and it doesn't give you any ability to predict ahead of time what the market's going to do. Charlie's prediction here is not that the market's going down. His prediction is if the market starts going down for whatever reason, it could be vulnerable to a rapid acceleration and a self-exacerbating vicious cycle to the downside if and only if, for whatever other reason, it finds itself below 2780 on the S&P for the next couple of weeks. In any event, we need your help, folks. You know, we have more than 50,000 regular listeners to Macro Voices, and only about 5 or 6 of you regularly retweet our tweets to help us to promote the show. We'd really appreciate more participation. After all, the more that we can do to promote Macro Voices and get more listeners, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best feature interview guests for our upcoming shows. So please do your part. Help us by forwarding your research roundup emails, telling your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Only takes a minute. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
So this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Art, as well as the link to his slide deck that he was referencing throughout the presentation. There's also an article from Michael Batnick titled The 20 Craziest Investment Facts Ever, as well as a link to a great Jeremy Grantham interview on CNBC. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share the content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.